Continue with Fred Hoyle on 22 May 88.
It's the dominant force in science today is the religious concept, I think.
And it was in the 50s also, I mean?
Oh, it's been there all the time, right. Yes. The American scientists who are so... concerned about these creationists in biology don't seem to realize that they themselves are creationists where the universe is concerned. they didn't get to the stage of a whole huge number of Nobel laureates sending a petition to the Supreme Court about these chaps. But my feeling is a century from now, it will seem just as absurd to say the universe is 10 billion years old as it is to say that it's 5,000 years old. Mm-hmm. I think that is the way it will come out. Right. So I think it's we're a little bit more sophisticated than the creationists, but I think it's the same story. I think the human brain has a sort of trend towards creationism.
A need for a beginning.
It stops further inquiry, doesn't it?
It solves the endless regression.
It's what I was saying yesterday. Tommy's remark is the best. The universe is what it is because it was what it was. And that solves the problem. Mm-hmm. And that's the way to cope with it. Whereas the alternative way, you have to examine every question. So I think it's quite correct what you say, that I had a sort of built-in dislike of the finite beginning, but it wasn't very strong in those days. It was a sort of feeling, but it wasn't in any sense overriding. Mm-hmm. Well, but certainly Bondi and I must have both felt that, because we've been sparring from the time we read Robertson's article with all sorts of ideas for avoiding the singularity, the time singularity. And so we must have... what we did not conceive of is the modern way of avoiding a literal singularity by means of a quantum state. Mm-hmm. We didn't conceive of that.
Yeah. Well, let me ask... at that stage when the theory was being developed in the late 40s, what did you see then as the main test to distinguish?
Well, we saw that any phenomenon, if it is steady enough, will form a test just by looking back in time, right, and seeing whether it's the same then.
But which then did you think
we saw the theory was immensely testable, and as Bondi's never ceased to emphasize quite correctly, that is the mark of a good theory, that mm-hmm. it is instantly exposed to test. But again, it was Tommy who had the perception. He said, of course, this means that any wrong observation is going to look like a disproof of the theory. And
he said that from the beginning?
Right from the beginning, or almost the beginning.
Prophetic.
Almost the beginning. He tried to... The two people who went around preaching the testability of the theory were Hermann and Denis Yama. I was a little bit more cautious, because I had realized that what I said in my talk yesterday, that... a car can proceed steadily, but it doesn't mean that, even though the cycles repeat themselves, it doesn't mean that within a cycle things have to be steady. I pointed out that in 1949, against my colleagues Bondi and Gall. That's where we differed. Mm-hmm. They wanted everything, at least Bondi wanted everything so smooth that it was immensely testable.
Yeah.
So I said it might not be so. If the Hubble time is the cycle time, things might be like the inflow and outflow of the gases in an engine.
In
an automobile. I wasn't sold on this at all. When we got into the trouble with Ryle,
just before we get to that, did you see? I mean, which test did you think might be feasible? I mean, in the late 40s, were you thinking galaxy counts, for instance?
We discussed that a lot, but we decided it wasn't on. We were skeptical at a time when Hubble was optimistic that he could do it. Bondi talked about the galaxy counts, and he was quite keen on them. But I felt that I had enough grasp of astronomical observations to realize it was very difficult. I knew about the immense difficulty of standardizing the plates at low flux values by photographic techniques. And so I wasn't altogether sold on that.
What did you like as a test, or did you really not see anything at that time?
Well, I think my views were more oriented towards star formation. I think I had already seen from an early time that the presence of the same elements in more distant galaxies, that kind of thing would be more the way I was thinking.
Right.
I was thinking about origin of elements in stars, and that, therefore if it's being ongoing, we ought to see the same elements however far we see back in time. I think that I was thinking more astrophysically like that. When Sandage produced his Q0 values, his...
this is now the late 50s.
Getting into the middle 50s. I was surprised that they were able to do it. I was always surprised that they were able to correct the magnitudes well enough to do it. And so that came as rather a surprise.
Right.
Then there was a period when Albert Whitford thought he had a test on the reddening effect.
That's right. The Whitford-Stebbins effect. Yes,
that's right. Stebbins-Whitford effect. Where he calibrated, I think, on one of the Andromeda satellites, something like that, and then looked back in, and said there was more reddening than there should be. That was interesting to me, and I had a lot of talk with Albert over there, but he finally decided his calibration was wrong.
Right.
He told
right.
me that.
Yeah.
So, as it were, it looked quite good. The theory seemed to fit. It fitted the age questions. That fell into line. The Stebbins-Whitford effect disappeared, we seemed to see the same elements in the galaxies and so forth. So when Sandage came along, it was a bit of a surprise to me. So I said in Pasadena in in the early 50s or whenever it was, well, if this holds up, it's wrong. The theory is wrong. I've never been entirely comfortable, as I said yesterday, about that Q0 business. But what actually happened is a girl called Elizabeth Scott. She's one of...
I know the name.
Yeah.
Worked with Jerzy Neyman.
Yeah, that's right. Neyman's pupil. She came along and pointed out that Sandage might be moving the goalposts. Because as you go to greater distances, the brighter individuals may not be the same as the ones close by.
This is now about 1960 or in that
era. Well, it's a bit before that.
A little bit before that.
Before that. I should say I would have said about 1957 or something.
Well, before we get to the 2C and so forth itself, as we go from the period of 1950 to 1955, several radio surveys are coming out from Jodrell, from Australia, from Cambridge. How were your views on radio sources changing, or were you just completely puzzled as you began to get 10, 15 identifications and it was such a
grab bag of objects? Well, it never occurred to me that these were going to be of cosmological significance, because when we began to get the sources, my first thought is we've got to find out what they are.
Right.
And so I would never have had Ryle's concept of trying to do cosmology from things I didn't know
But
about.
Even with Cygnus A, at such a high redshift, and yet the second strongest source in the sky, that didn't make you think that maybe these things are really far away.
Oh yes, yes.
But you'd want to have it established before you...
No doubt that many of the things might be far away. But it isn't my my mentality to feel that you can settle a big question from something you don't know about. My feeling was we've got to find more of them.
Yeah.
So although I'm a theoretician, I don't believe anything that's observational unless it's really good. You see, I'm a great believer in good observation. And from the time I met Walter Bader in 1944, he had a very big effect because he's really the first great astronomical observer I've ever met. Mm-hmm. And Bader totally convinced me that you never believe anything unless it's really first class. Mm-hmm. Because he knew of so many mistakes. I mean, we talk about people like Van Manen and so on. And,
yeah.
So I was never worried at all through the Ryle episode about the scientific issues, because I knew the data just wasn't first class, and so I wasn't worried. But what I was worried about was the insistent public attacks.
Yeah, yeah. But before we get to that, how did you know the data weren't good? Was that because of the comparison with Mills, or even before then? Actually, I guess it's only a few months before that conflict came in, because just to remind you of the sequence, Ryle's Halley lecture was in May 1955. Well, I should ask you, did you know about the results before that time? So, no. Did you have any idea that they were doing cosmology?
No.
Okay, so that was just a real surprise. So that was his Halley lecture. Then the Jodrell Bank IAU symposium on radio astronomy was in August.
That's right.
And that is where Pawsey presented Mills's very preliminary results.
So I tend to say, well, it's my feeling. I knew that I'm always suspicious, for instance, of people who don't tell me what they're doing. I mean, you can see, you talked to Bob Wilson. Well, I've known Bob since he was a student at Caltech, but we've always been friendly, and he would tell me straight away what he was doing, and right. that's the way I understand does science. So I was sort of worried that these things came out as a bolt from the blue. And then my colleagues, such as Mills and Bolton, told me that there were questions. You see, one of the things that I was suspicious about, and it vitiated the 4C results in the early 60s, were the flux measurements. The receivers weren't good, and it is a clear thing that one could readily deduce that if you are making mistakes in the flux values, even if the mistakes are random, it has the effect of steepening the curve.
Right.
This was pointed out by Bolton, and so. I really wasn't too worried about the scientific aspects of the business. I was just mad that in my own university I was subject to these sort of attacks.
Yeah. Well, Peter Scheuer yesterday referred to the accusation of that we had a secret method and that we wouldn't publish it. Is that something you felt at that time? Referring to the P of D method now.
I would have said that that it was more a matter that people didn't understand it. They felt that they were dredging something up out of nowhere, that it was a kind of rabbit's down the conjurer's sleeve,
mm-hmm.
and that the data ought to be cleaner than that.
If you have to resort to that kind of thing, then you're in trouble.
You're in trouble. I think that's what was more the way people felt about it.
But in retrospect,
I think was that
fair? I mean, were they a bit ahead of their time in terms of the way one does simulations now? And indeed, you can get information.
Statistical sense. You can get it that way. It's clear. It was clear that that mathematically you could get it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the question was, were they doing it right? And the other thing which worried me about Ryle was that he didn't seem to understand what a mathematician would understand, that if you have information which is in some degree suspect but is interesting, that is okay to support a theory, but you can't disprove theories except by data that is unequivocal. There is a total difference. It's just as in mathematics, you cannot... If you really studied accurate mathematics, you know perfectly well that you can't establish a negative except by the most rigorous reasoning. And he wasn't doing that. And he never did it to the end of his days. He never really produced it.
That's a very interesting point. I've never thought of it that way. That that he was really had a negative result, and yeah. and one always has to work so much harder for
that's
a negative
right.
result.
That's right. That's right.
But I've never thought of the refutation of a theory as being a negative result.
I mean, if you get there's all sorts of things where you get a bit of positive information. It's not decisive, but that's fine. I mean,
yes,
but
right.
the other way around,
right.
it has to be
yes.
absolutely
yes.
absolutely clear cut.
Very interesting. Now, the Paris Symposium must have been a very interesting meeting. I've always looked upon it as sort of a watershed in the history of radio astronomy. Sort of the last time that all the radio astronomers in the world could have a meeting called radio astronomy and could
yes.
all be in the same room. And of course, it's especially interesting because of the conflicts over the source counts and so forth. And you were there. What is your recollection of that meeting?
Well, I think the written record will show I took no part in it. I left it to the observers to...
Oh, you mean in terms of making comments?
Yes.
Yeah, but you did give a summarizing lecture, and you also did give a talk on...
Yes.
On,
that's right.
On radio source mechanisms, I believe.
On angular diameters.
Oh, that's right. You talked about the angular diameter test.
That's produced the test of the testing but, cosmology by the angular...
But do you just have any recollections about the flavor of the meeting and... Was it just people arguing and really not listening to each other at all?
I was trying to balance in my mind the comparative technical ability of the two groups.
Mm-hmm. This was your first contact with the Australians,
oh,
probably.
No. My first contact was when they threw John Bolton out of the Cavendish, which must have been
yes.
the early 50s.
Would you tell me that...
I can't remember the exact year.
Well, no, I can tell you. It was May 1950 when he
visited the Cavendish. They allowed John into the Cavendish, I think, for a day or something, and then he was told by the secretary to clear out. And I don't remember exactly. He must have come to see me. That must have been it. And I invited him into dinner in John's.
Mm-hmm.
And then these things began to come out. And from then onwards, my contact with the Australians was fairly good.
Mm-hmm.
Because John had not yet fallen out with Bernard Mills over the struggle between high frequency and low frequency.
Oh, yes, this is long before that.
And so. I think I was in pretty good contact with the Australians from that time on. I would have remembered it as 1950. Yeah.
Right. No, it was. Yeah. Did you have any other contact with them before the Paris Symposium?
Oh, well, you mentioned the Jodrell
Bank. Oh, the Jodrell Bank,
yeah,
of course,
yeah,
that's right.
With Bernie Mills.
I wasn't at that meeting, actually, only Pawsey.
It's Pawsey.
It was
Joe Pawsey, wasn't it?
That's right.
The talk. That's right. And Joe was a very mild sort of person.
Right.
But for him, he was pretty acid when he compared their... observation of Sagittarius with the Cambridge observation.
Mm. Okay, well, back to the Paris Symposium. You say you're trying to gauge the technical skills, and were you able to come to any conclusions at that time?
No, I came to the conclusion that either side might be right, and as I always do in these matters, I say the universe isn't there for our exploitation at all. The universe will have a final say, and I don't have any difficulty in waiting.
Right.
I've waited
right.
30 years, but now I feel I know the answer. So I don't have any feelings at all about this.
What did you make of the fact that despite more surveys and better positions, presumably, and so forth, you still were not getting... you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of optical identifications in the late 50s, you know, the number had gone up by that time to maybe 30 or 40 identifications, half of which were normal galaxies anyway. What did you make of that? Did you think it was just the unreliability of the radio positions, or...?
Partly. Mm. Partly. It confirmed my feeling that the data really wasn't very good. One thing that was interesting in the Paris meeting and in the subsequent IAU was the feeling that how difficult it will be to get identifications. I remember that. if we'd been told that the number of identifications would run to many thousands 30 years later, we would all have been astonished.
Right.
It was felt to be an almost impassable barrier at that time.
Can you remember discussions with Botta or Minkowski
at that era? Oh yes, many.
Yeah. Can you tell me about what their attitudes...
Well, they felt the same way about the identifications. The sort of things we used to get excited about when Jennison found that Cygnus A was double.
Yes.
And he got the distance apart. That things like that and that the radio galaxies had this pattern of double sources. Those are the sort of details that, whereas nowadays you wouldn't think maybe these were so important.
Well, but that was clearly a big breakthrough.
But it was that kind of thing that used to occupy one's mind. After the Paris Symposium, I went to there was a meeting at IU in Moscow,
right?
And we filled in about a week by going to Leiden. Mm-hmm. And Oort invited Tommy and I to Leiden and Bernie Mills, mm-hmm. and we went out sailing together. So I had a long talk with Bernard at that time, but I thought Peter wasn't really fair. I never really felt that the Australians were anything other than very polite.
Yeah, Peter Scheuer, you're saying in his talk yesterday.
Yeah, he seemed to imply that the Australians attacked them viciously. I don't remember it.
Well,
I don't remember it that way. Even in private, Bernie Mills was still quite restrained in his remarks.
Well, but then Peter, he didn't say it yesterday, but last night he remarked to me. But then he was amazed. A year after the Paris Symposium, there's an invitation from Pawsey and Mills to come join them for 2 years, which he then did. And he said Mills, you know, met him at the ship and took him out and had a beer and.
Well,
he was amazed at that.
Yes, but you see, I think what happened is that Bondi was very close to the thing when he called Ryle a paranoid, that he imbued his students with a feeling that they were under attack.
Yes.
That he felt it.
Yes.
And so they were amazed.
Because they had an intense loyalty.
When they found it wasn't so.
Yes.
My feeling is the Australians attacked each other much more over the struggle, and then later over the design of optical telescopes than they ever attacked Ryle.
Yeah.
I mentioned going sailing with Oort and Bernie Mills, naturally, we had these discussions, and I remember Bernard as being very restrained.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Although I would say that his 1957 paper, which I quoted briefly from yesterday at this meeting, certainly has some very strong statements. You know, the Cambridge results are wrong. It's the kind of thing you don't normally write papers in that.
Well, they were wrong. They got -3, and that was pretty bad. Mills, I remember, in his first paper, didn't he get -1.8?
In his first paper,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, and then he eventually came to 1.7 or something. Well, Bernie was very close.
Yeah,
It was a good observation. So,
but still, one normally couches in scientific papers results like this in milder language.
Well, you don't necessarily, if one of your friends has been thrown out of the Cavendish, maybe you don't.
Well, yeah. Well, let's just finish up on this, and then I'd like to spend a little time on the radio source mechanisms, and then end up with the discovery of the microwave background and how you felt that affected cosmology, both for you and for the community as a whole. As time went on, from 1955 into the early 60s, you began to have, of course, the 3C, then the 3CR, and then the 4C survey. Did you feel that things were improving at all, or did you sort of give up on radio source counts? It was just getting more and more muddled as time went on.
I then turned to the position that I've been in from the beginning, that the cycle time in the steady state theory might be of the order of the Hubble time. And in fact, Nalin Kaur and I wrote a paper about 61, in which I think we took the regularity time at about a third of the Hubble. Mm-hmm. The Hubble time, and we showed that in that kind of if the events were not smooth over a time of the order, I think in fact we took a tenth of the Hubble time. The distance that sticks in my mind is 300 megaparsecs, we showed that if we allowed the situation to be irregular on a scale of a tenth of a Hubble period, we could get slopes as steep as minus two. And we proved this from computer simulation and so Monte Carlo techniques. The paper is in the monthly notices, so I didn't really worry about those steep slopes because to me it seemed all it implied is a certain degree of irregularity in the engine. And so I was never worried.
Now what about the possibility of local...
What worried me more than Ryle was the fact that Bundy and Sciama both have propagandized so much for the completely smooth interpretation of the theory that it's very difficult to get people to realize that, as I said, the fuel cycle of an engine takes a whole cycle time before it repeats itself. And so...
This cycle idea on a large scale did not appeal to them.
They felt
that that was degrading the theory somewhat and losing some of its attractiveness.
Well, that's what people said, but to me, logically, it made no difference. So I was a bit annoyed that people wouldn't listen to the logic. I only get annoyed when people want to ignore the logic. And the logic was that you could perfectly well have this system of cosmology where events. So when I look at the world, I don't see everything as smooth. There are all sorts of turbulence in the air and so on. And so I expect it will be the same in cosmology. And you try the simplest thing first, and if the simplest thing doesn't work, then you try the next simplest thing. And so Nalikar and I, as I remember, we didn't go to the full extent. We went to about a tenth of it, and we showed that already if it was regular, if there's a sort of time turbulence on the scale of a tenth of the Hubble time, that we could get the steep slope. We got all slopes down from about 1.3 to 2 or something like that.
There was also quite a bit of discussion about the possibility of a local hole in the lack of the bright.
And Peter wasn't correct yesterday when he said that the ground shifted on the steep counts. So that it was a question of whether where you set the levels,
right?
That it could be explained with a deficiency of only about 50 sources. That only occurred in the late 60s. I give a talk at the Bakerian lecture at the Royal Society in 68, I think it was, in which I pointed out that It may not be the slope that's rising steeply, it might just be the bottom end that's a little low because about 50 sources were missing. So that one couldn't really make too much of a song and dance over 50 sources.
Speaking of Bakerian lectures, you reminded me of Ryle's 1958 lecture. Did you hear that perchance? His Bakerian lecture in 1958, in which the Cambridge group always considers that as a masterpiece, a logical demonstration using what identifications there were, using the source counts, that these things really were extragalactic. At some stage, of course, you must have also been convinced that they were extragalactic, that the situation improved from 1955. What was it that gradually made you be willing to accept that these things really were extragalactic and therefore, you should pay attention to the source counts.
I suspected they're extragalactic long ahead of Ryle.
Well, but I mean, what I meant was that you were pretty convinced that they were extragalactic.
Yeah.
Was there any turning?
The Bader-Smith determination of Cygnus A.
Well, no.
That settled it.
Well, no. What I meant is, are you saying that when 2C came out, you had no doubts they were extragalactic, were not understood that bothered you?
I no doubt that.
Nothing about their luminosity function, for instance, was known, and this kind of thing.
No doubt.
I see. When you said that they weren't understood at all, you meant it was still an open question.
Not at all. We knew the isotropic component was extragalactic.
Okay.
But we didn't know where they were.
Right, and you didn't know the luminosity function, et cetera. Okay, I misunderstood.
I mean, they might have been a local cloud, within the nearest 10 megaparsecs for all we knew.
Right.
But when Bader discovered the redshift of 17,000 kilometers a second, you began to suspect that they were much further out.
Yeah.
And you could say that they're going to be eventual use for cosmology, but my feeling, I didn't suspect an attack from that quarter at all, because I felt we were so far away from knowing enough about them to be, as I say, I've always had the attitude that I only believe data that's unequivocal.
Mm-hmm.
And it would never have occurred to me that you would try to disprove a theory by data that was as vague as that. So I had no such thought at all. Besides which, of course, by this time, I knew Edwin Hubble extremely well, because whenever I was in Pasadena, we always used to go every Sunday morning, we walked together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that by now the inside story of all the difficulty of counting galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that you know what a galaxy is, and you can count it far more of them than radio sources. So it would never have occurred to me in 1955 that one would have this kind of thing at all.
Interesting. Let me just ask, I've never looked in Hubble's papers or anything. Do you have any recollections of what his attitude was towards this new radio astronomy? Of course, he died in 53, I believe it was. But
no, it was about 1960, 59 sometime.
No, it was 53.
Was it?
Year he got the gold medal RAS.
You're quite right, yes.
But do you have any recollections about what he thought of radio astronomy? I'd just be curious.
I don't think we ever discussed it.
Probably not. No. Another question: did you ever carry on discussions through the 50s with any of Ryle's students, or was it really the whole group?
That was forbidden.
That was forbidden.
I can tell you one event from the 60s and show us the way it was. I had somebody visit me because a Russian astronomer had been jailed. On what was said to be very flimsy ground. A chap came to me and see me, a Dutchman, and said, was there any way I could do anything for him?
Mm-hmm.
That it was felt that if I could approach Ambatsumia, that they knew I knew Victor quite well, something might be done for him. It was pretty much that he hadn't really done anything. He translated a few Western books, you know, it's one of these cases. And some of the literature that the Dutchman brought me was in Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get a translation of them. And I knew that Malcolm Wong spoke Russian or knew enough Russian.
Right.
So I rang up Malcolm and said, would you come, can we meet? And Longyear...
He was a graduate student at that.
Yes,
in
Ryle's department.
Must be the late 60s or something.
Longyear wouldn't come until the department had shut after 5 o'clock, because he didn't care to tell Ryle he was coming to see me.
I see. Amazing.
And Ryle wouldn't add his name to the letter I wrote to Ambatsumia. I tried to get him to write it. So I sort of kind of despised him.
Well,
so that was, so relations really were very bad, and they continued to grow worse. I think there's only one person, and yet I feel somehow that it was just unfortunate that I inherited the enmity between Gold and Ryle. But I don't think there's any way in which it could have been different. As someone put it to me, Ryle's real ambition was to be a theoretician, and so he could never let it go. And, well, you just have to take his luck in how it turns out, I suppose.
The quasars. I didn't realize that you had been in Pasadena during the year or two in which one had these spectra and couldn't do anything with them. Can you tell me?
I was there at the time.
Yeah, can you tell me about your recollections
of
that time?
I know is that Greenstein had the spectrum of 3C48, but I didn't know at that time the Sandage's part in it. Otherwise, if I'd gone to see Alan, I might have got a chance. But Greenstein wouldn't let any of us look at it.
I see.
So that was the problem. And he was subsequently punished, because if he had, perhaps we would have got the red ship.
Before Schmidt.
But John Bolton, whether John is romancing or not, I don't know, has always told me since that he was there. And because he was in the same building, he managed to get a look at the spectrum. And he had always claimed that he had proposed that it be looked at as a large redshift object.
And it was dismissed as being unreasonable? Or?
I don't know, but what was never done in any seminar was to say, this is a very interesting spectrum, to show us it and write the wavelengths down.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's almost certain that we would have got the community generally.
With 10 or 20 people
but
playing.
But Greenstein sat on it, feeling that as long as he kept the data in his desk, he might see what it meant.
Yeah.
And he was subsequently punished for this.
Right.
But the story then is that Bolton had always wanted to build a high-frequency... What actually happened was when Caltech wanted to start radio astronomy, Lee DuBridge, who knew Taffy Bourne very well, said, who should I appoint?
Right.
And Taffy went to John and said, well, here's your chance. You believe in high frequency.
Right.
If you want the job, it's there. And that's why Owens Valley went to high frequency straight away. That's the reason for that. And when Taffy had finished the 210 foot at Parks, he wanted somebody to run it, and so he asked John to come back to do it. And so John returned to Australia, but he had all these things about 3C48 in his head. And when Cyril Hazard, Cyril was a vague sort of individual, shifted from one appointment to another, and he eventually wound up in Harry Messel's department.
Right. I have talked to him about this.
Well, Cyril knew that 3C273 was going behind the moon, and that it only does it once every 18 years, I suppose. And he applied for time. I mean, if Cyril hadn't been such a vague individual, he would have realized that the ill feeling between Messel and Bowen was so great that he wasn't going to get it.
Right.
So his application went in, and the person who prevented it being thrown out was John Bolton. John said to Taffy, this is important, you really must give him the time. And so they put the chap, his name begins with S, to work with
Shimmons.
Shimmons, yes. That's right. They put Shimmons in to work with Cyril. You should hear Ed Nye. Ed Nye was there at the time to tell the story about how he thought he was doing important work helping Hanbury Brown at Narrabri, whereas all the time Cyril was down at Parks doing the really important thing in his vague sort of way.
Right.
But anyway, Cyril got the position. John realised that if he left the matter with Cyril, nothing would be done about it. At least there would be a publication eventually in a vague sort of way.
Yeah.
But that it was very important. And now this is the key thing in the history of the discovery of quasars, was who that John wrote and gave the position away to, because the position was so definite that you could be sure of the object. And so the history of the discovery of quasars now turns on who John sent that letter to. Well, he could have sent it to send it to Alan Sanders, you send it to Margaret Burbage. He chose to send it to Martin Schmidt. And that Caltech, that part of the story, there's no way Martin Schmidt would have made the discovery if he hadn't got that letter.
No, I mean, I've always considered it as a co-discovery. I mean, it depends on how you define discovery. I mean,
yeah, but if you read the way critical. Caltech...
I agree. No, it's a Caltech discovery, sure.
Oh, well, you know it. That's all right. Yeah.
Oh, no, I know about this. I think it was actually Cyril that sent the letter, though, but undoubtedly it was John who told him who to send it to.
It might have been. Yeah, he might have told him.
Cyril has given me a copy of the letter.
But
why did John choose Martin Schmidt?
Because he'd been in the same department.
Well, but I mean, as opposed to Greenstein.
Well, I think it's because Greenstein hadn't really shown he'd been so secretive about the 3C48 that John felt that he'd be secretive about this too, probably.
Right. But now what? 3C2. Let's see. I'm trying to think now. So Bolton would have been definitely thinking that this could be another one of these strange stars.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, sure. That he yes. might. I don't think John had the concept that it might be the giveaway it finally was in having the Bomber series easily right. identifiable.
Right. Well, giveaway, I think maybe too easy a term. I mean,
well, when you've got three lines of the Bomber series, it's hardly avoidable.
And of course, the redshift wasn't that high, also. That helped a lot. But now, okay, so now the quasars break onto the scene, or do you know more about the Caltech story? Were you there when that discovery was made, and shortly thereafter?
I wasn't actually there. I was traveling back from Australia, and I passed through Pasadena, and Willie Fowler and I had generalized a concept of Jeff Burbidge's. Jeff had kind of claimed that the only thing that would give the energy of the radio sources was a whole series of supernova explosions. Mm-hmm. But he never explained how these were together. So Willie and I started to think about massive objects, really big masses. We started with nuclear energy, but we toward the end of that year, which was 62, I realized that nuclear energy wouldn't do it, at least we both realized nuclear energy wouldn't do it. And the reason I went to Pasadena was to finalize a letter to Nature with Willie, in which we proposed that it was gravitation, strong gravitation, that was responsible for
right.
the energy source.
And that came out in 62, I believe?
That must have been January Nature, probably, in 63.
63, okay.
Yeah. And I went, Martin Schmidt and Alan Sanders were giving a joint paper in New York on the nature of these objects. I suppose they were.
Was this the AAS meeting, I believe, or was it the New York Academy of Sciences?
Yeah. Now, what would they call them at that time? They would be. There would be radio sources, compact radio sources. They would be looking at them. It wouldn't have got the spectrum, but it was a sort of. By now, it was recognized that there was a class of unresolved.
That's right. You had many
sources,
doubles,
which started with Hanbury Brown,
right?
With the Brown Palmer Allen
right.
stuff at Jodrell.
And it was clear the spectrum was different for these compact sources.
And so
right.
they were giving a paper, and they'd more or less gone back to the early sort of radio source idea of local stars.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that was ever published. I think they suppressed what they said at that.
Yes, that's right.
Is that right?
Yes, correct. It was not published, right?
Yes, that's right. They suppressed it smartly.
Were you at that meeting?
No, but I talked about the paper that they were going to give with Martin in his office on the first floor of Robinson. And I said to Martin, do you think there's any possibility that what you're really seeing are these kind of objects that Willie and I have been investigating?
Mm-hmm.
And he told me in the typical Dutch fashion that he didn't think there was much possibility of that. So that was the way the story ended for me personally. That
but
I always felt that conversation ought to be mentioned. The next thing I heard, and I heard it one day ahead of doing a program for the BBC, I got a letter from Willie, which was about some nuclear thing, but at the bottom, he just wrote, whoopee, they found our object.